What I'd like to do this afternoon in a few minutes is talk a little bit about whether the ways in which our policies either do or don't get us where we need to go with regard to adolescence and STD prevention. And in doing that, I'd like to talk a little bit about how we view adolescence and what are our goals in this area, what role does knowledge play, and what actions need to be taken, what health care needs to be accessible, and the roles that policies play, and who needs to be involved and how. First of all, I think it's important to ask the question of whether our perceptions of adolescence match reality, and a lot of what Ron was talking about, obviously, is relevant to that. But one of the sort of prevalent notions about adolescence is that they're healthy. Another question that I think is important to look at is how well do we understand where teens are getting their information? And in that regard, you know, we think about parents, we think about school, and of course, increasingly, we need to be thinking about the internet. Do we know enough about adolescent behaviors and their consequences? And I'll say a few words in that context about some recent research that came out about virginity pledges. So teens are healthy, but as Ron explained, there are also dramatic increases in morbidity during the teen years. And much of this is related to preventable health conditions with primarily behavioral, environmental, and social etiologies. And of course, for this conference, one of the key issues that we need to be concerned about is that adolescents and young adults have the highest rates of most STDs of any age group. And so we need to really re-examine our premise that adolescents are healthy in a context where that healthiness really is set side by side with some very serious, very challenging health problems, STDs among them, that can have lifelong implications for their futures, for their childbearing potential, for their overall health, and for the public health. So where do teens get their information, and how are they sharing it? There's been a lot of research recently and a lot of documentation, and those of you who have teenagers at home see this on a day-to-day basis, of course, and that is that there are exceedingly high rates of sort of participation in digital forms or electronic forms of communication. The Society for Adolescent Medicine, which has Kathleen mentioned I'm president of this year, is going to have its conference next year in Los Angeles and focus on adolescence and electronic media, because it's such a current and critical issue for understanding the world that adolescents live in. And there's been some fascinating documentaries and programming on television recently exploring that world and how it really works for teenagers. The Pew Research Center recently issued a report showing that 93% of teens use the internet. Nearly two-thirds have themselves created online content, and more than half have created a profile on a social networking site. So any kinds of interventions or policies that we have or might develop with regard to STD prevention needs to take that reality into consideration. Another issue that I think we need to keep in mind is that the kinds of expectations we have about various interventions, various kinds of programming, and various kinds of policies may not always lead to expected results. And I'll take the case that was reported on last year in the Journal of Adolescent Health, a study by Bruckner and Behrman about virginity pledges. And what they found was that although virginity pledges and young women who take them or young men who take them are expected to avoid consequences of sexual activity that we would like to see them avoid, such as STDs in pregnancy, the data that they derived from their research actually suggested some very unexpected consequences, which is that STD infection rates do not appear to differ between those who have taken virginity pledges and those who have not. So again, our reality has to adjust for these unexpected kinds of consequences that result from interventions, from programming, and from policies. Clearly, essential goals in this arena are that we want to reduce the incidence and prevalence of STDs in adolescents, and we want to limit the harmful sequelae of STDs for infected adolescents and their sexual partners, and of course, for others in the public. So in order to do that, we need to think about a variety of different kinds of factors, and one of those is that adolescents need to know the basics about STDs, about prevention, about screening, about diagnosis, and about treatment. And the information they have must be accurate. The sources of information that they are exposed to are inevitably diverse, and we need to take that into consideration. And the knowledge that they have must somehow lead to action. So that reminds us what I was saying about where do teens get their information and how do they share it? And does reality match expectations in terms of knowledge or leading to actions? So what kinds of actions are we trying to promote among adolescents? Refraining from sex, postponing sexual debut, engaging in safer sex, seeking regular preventive diagnostic and treatment health services, complying with healthcare providers' recommendations. We want adolescents to have access, or adolescents need to have access, to comprehensive, accessible health care for prevention, for screening and diagnosis, and for treatment. And that health care needs to be age appropriate, and it needs to incorporate adolescent-friendly services. So we need policies that will promote knowledge, action, and health care access. And I could generate a list that would go on for several slides about the different kinds of policies that we need. But this afternoon, very briefly, I want to focus on just four areas: sexuality education, consent, confidentiality, and financial access. And I'm going to move very quickly through these, and we can come back to them later in the discussion section. As I'm sure everyone in this room knows, there's been dramatic increases over the last decade in federal funding for abstinence-only sex education, but increasingly we're learning that adults and the scientific community favor a more balanced approach, and as a result, states are beginning to take some action. They're beginning to require legally that there be medical accuracy in the content of sexuality education programs, and increasingly states are rejecting federal funds in order to be able to offer more comprehensive sex education programs. In terms of consent for health care for minors, I'm going to run through this very, very quickly. Of course, the basic rule is parental consent, but that there are alternatives for that, and one of the major alternatives is minor consent. These laws date back more than half a century. They expanded from the middle of the century for a couple of decades and became stable, and then sort of continued stable, but with attempts showing up to repeal or change those laws. Every state has minor consent laws, and some of them are based on the status of the minor and some on the services the minor is seeking. Those that are based on the status of the minor run across quite a diverse array of different kinds of living situations and characteristics, and any of those minors would generally be able to consent to all of their own health care, particularly health care for STDs. Consent laws that are based on services have focused frequently on pregnancy-related care, which has been a controversial area with respect to abortion, but also on areas such as STD prevention, reportable prevention, diagnosis, and treatment, reportable disease prevention, diagnosis, and treatment, and other kinds of services. One of the key issues for adolescents, and this relates to a variety of developmental factors, which we can come back to in the discussion time if we have a chance, is that confidentiality protection has been documented to be a significant concern and have a major impact on their willingness to use health care and on their actual use of it. The rationales for protecting confidentiality include avoiding negative health outcomes both for adolescents and the public. There are pragmatic arguments that healthcare conversations, if they're not private, simply may not take place, and that many teens have few opportunities for frank discussion of sensitive topics and need to have those opportunities, and the healthcare setting is one place they can do that. As I mentioned, we have an extensive body of research that documents that privacy concerns can lead to adolescents avoiding seeking care, lead them to stop using services, go to a different site or provider, decline specific services, or even limit their candor with their healthcare professionals. Confidentiality, I think it's always important to point out, is not without limitations. And the limitations relate to such things as the need to report abuse and neglect, the concerns about imminent serious harm to self or others, concerns around billing of insurance, discoverable medical records, and whether or not office agreements that are signed saying that care can be received on a confidential basis by an adolescent are valid or binding in any way. I think it's important for us to remember that parents and adolescents are really in this together. Even though adolescence may sometimes appear to be a time of big battles between generations and challenges of that sort, they really are on the same page, and their interests are not inherently in conflict at all. And to the contrary, they're really inherently very consistent. And it's important to remember that voluntary communication is important, that many parents are supportive, that many adolescents do choose to talk with their parents about confidential and sensitive issues, but also that mandated communication can be counterproductive because some families are dysfunctional, and some adolescents simply insist on some autonomy at different points in their developmental trajectory. The legal framework for confidential care, and again I'm going to move through this very quickly, has very diverse sources in a wide variety of different kinds of laws, and it's important to remember that there is a strong link but not a perfect match between consent laws and confidentiality laws. And that the minor consent laws are only one source of confidentiality protections or confidentiality requirements, and there are many others as well. And I've listed a few of them here, both at the state level and at the federal level. And of course, all of you, I'm sure, if not professionally, personally, have encountered the HIPAA privacy rule when you have to sign a bunch of fine print in the doctor's office. But it's a very important rule in terms of how confidentiality issues play out for adolescents in the healthcare setting. And the important thing to remember is that while the HIPAA privacy rule is a federal law, it actually does not ultimately determine what information can or should or must or may not be disclosed to parents. That is determined by reference to other laws, and largely those other laws are the state minor consent laws. And the limitations, again, on confidentiality, which are important to remember, have to do with child abuse reporting and disclosure requirements when a minor is dangerous to self or others. I'm going to say just a word or two about financial access, and there's actually a separate session at this conference on Thursday morning about confidential care in the context of insurance and billing. But adolescents and young adults are uninsured at high rates, and even insured adolescents may not be able to access insurance for confidential care. And at the same time, public health and safety net providers and those providing family planning services have been under enormous stress recently, or increasingly over the years, as funding has not kept up with need or with inflation or with demand and necessity for services. So what kinds of policies do we need? We need policies that will ensure access to medically accurate, comprehensive information about abstinence and contraception in sex education programs. We need to ensure that adolescents may consent for prevention as well as for diagnosis and treatment for STDs, and only a very small handful of state laws actually mention the word prevention. Most of them only mention diagnosis and treatment. We need to ensure that confidentiality protections are in place for STD services and that adolescents can take advantage or be protected by those confidentiality requirements when they're accessing and using STD services. We need to ensure that benefit packages in public and private insurance cover all relevant preventive diagnostic and treatment services for STDs so that financial access is assured or improved over its current levels. And we need to find ways to enable adolescents with insurance to use the coverage that they have for confidential care. And so I'll just close by saying, indeed, adolescents are healthy, but that doesn't mean they're not at serious risk for STDs and are not being infected with STDs at higher rates than can be allowed to continue. That adolescents deserve accurate and comprehensive information, that they are capable of giving informed consent to health care and deserve access to confidential STD care, that parents can and often do support comprehensive sex education and access to confidential care, and they need to be supported in doing that, and that adolescents will benefit from improved financial access to health care for STDs, but not only adolescents, but the rest of us in society will benefit as well. Thank you.